Europe's far right is alive and pushing ahead and keeping tabs on its neighbors across the pond.
The European far right has its eyes trained across the Atlantic very, very closely and continue to really regularly talk about Donald Trump, talk about the supposed hijacking of the election.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, scientists want to start an observatory for viruses, looking for the next pandemic in human blood.
Each of us is this incredibly delicate sensor to all the pathogens that are flying around.
And for Mardi Gras, for Polish Americans, Fat Tuesday means indulging in a once-a-year treat on the eve of Lent.
Well, you're giving everything up for 40 days, so you might as well go big or go home.
How many punchki can you eat? Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Glad you could make it here. We begin today with Marine Le Pen, the face of the far right in France. For the past few years, she's been trying to remake her image and recast her National Rally Party away from its extremist roots. Le Pen plans to challenge the incumbent, President Emmanuel Macron, in next year's presidential election, and her first steps have already made an impact on French politics. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry reports.
For the past 10 months, Marine Le Pen has kept a low profile in France. Unlike other far-right leaders in Europe, she hasn't been speaking out against government-imposed lockdowns or spouting anti-vaccine conspiracy theories. But on Friday, she made the headlines.
Bonsoir et bienvenue à vous, Marine
Bonsoir.
Le Pen.
Bonsoir.
On rappelle que vous êtes déjà candidate à la présidence de la République pour l'an prochain.
It was a TV debate with the government's interior minister, Gérald Darmanin. The event was seen by many as Le Pen's opening shot for a run at the French presidency. The most talked about moment, though, was a comment from the interior minister.
Madame Le Pen, dans sa stratégie de dédiabolisation, on vient à être quasiment un peu dans la mollesse. Je vous trouve, faut vous reprendre des vitamines. Vous n'êtes pas assez dur, je trouve, là.
Darmanin said Le Pen had gone a bit soft on radical Islam. Even Le Pen herself appeared taken aback. Philippe Marlier is professor of European politics at University College London. He says the interior minister did Le Pen an unexpected favour.
And what he did during this debate was constantly trying to outbid Le Pen on her right, you know, trying to be even more right-wing than Le Pen is on immigration, on Islam. And I think this is really terrible because Darmanin made her look good that day.
While the comment surprised many in France, it's also a reminder of just how much further to the right Macron's party has moved in recent months. He's taken a hard line in particular on Islamic radicalism, staking out a position that's not much different from Le Pen's. The National Rally leader has worked hard to change the image of her party by moving away from the radical far-right leadership of her father Jean-Marie. He was kicked out 6 years ago.
Expelled from the party he built from the ground, Jean-Marie Le Pen no longer has a place in the National Front.
But for many French voters, Philippe Marlier says, Le Pen will always be her father's daughter.
The Le Pen dynasty, father and daughter. The daughter is more palatable, but the father had a terrible reputation. A daughter does better, but I don't think she's particularly popular. The left absolutely hates her.
President Macron is sure to be watching closely. Recent opinion polls put him pretty much neck and neck with Marine Le Pen. Marta Lorimer, a researcher on the far right at Exeter University in Britain, says it's still early days.
Her recent doing better in the polls is largely down to the fact that at the moment she's one of the few candidates that we know will be running. And the other reason is that the campaign hasn't quite started yet.
Lorimer says Le Pen did well in the early polls before her 2017 presidential bid too. But there's another reason Le Pen is making news headlines now. She's on trial in Paris this month, accused of breaking hate speech laws. In 2015, Le Pen tweeted three gruesome images of Islamic State killings. One was a picture of the body of US journalist James Foley, who was murdered in Syria. Le Pen is facing charges of circulating violent messages that incite terrorism. But Marta Lorimer says this trial could actually boost her popularity.
She's not the only one who's shared these kind of images, but she is the only one who's being prosecuted. To an extent, this case can speak to her narrative that the elite, including the judiciary, is against them and really is doing its best to destroy the National Rally's electoral prospects.
Le Pen has other troubles too. The party doesn't have much money. And French journalist Pierre Haski says she and her National Rally colleagues still have to prove themselves.
Most people that are elected under her wing
are still inexperienced. There's a huge turnover. There have been a few scandals with some of them. So that's still part of the credibility gap that she'll have to bridge before the next presidential elections, is that, okay, you have a leader, but do you have a team?
Other presidential candidates will emerge in the coming months. But Haskey says Macron is most likely hoping that it's Le Pen he'll face in the final round of voting.
He still thinks that there is a majority in France that doesn't want to have a far-right president, and therefore she's Emmanuel Macron's favourite enemy.
Still, it's more than 12 months until the presidential election in France, giving Le Pen plenty of time to build support, and Macron a window to prove that he's worth the gamble second time around. No one is placing bets just yet on who gets to move into the Elysee Palace next year. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
The growing popularity of Marine Le Pen in France, the decade-long rule of authoritarian leader Viktor Orban in Hungary, just two signs that far-right movements in Europe are alive and well. A new report out today surveyed the political opinions of some 12,000 Europeans. It's called State of Hate, Far-Right Extremism in Europe. Joel Mulhall is one of the editors, and he joins us now from London. In a couple of sentences, Joe, how would you assess the level of hate across Europe right now? What is the headline?
Unfortunately, the headline is really worrying. I mean, we've had a worrying few years in terms of far-right extremism for a number of years now. As you mentioned, some of those big far-right parties, we've got far-right parties in parliaments across the continent. But also we've had a series of terrorist attacks in the last 3 or 4 years, which are worrying. And this report here actually does this big poll. And really sadly, the findings are really troubling. It finds that more than one in four of Europeans hold anti-minority sentiments. It says at least a quarter of Europeans have negative feelings towards Muslims. Almost a third have hostile views towards immigrants generally. And more than a third have negative views of Roma people, according to this poll. So we have a kind of worrying levels of prejudice across the continent, coupled with, obviously, that's transforming into votes because we're seeing the far right in parliamentary chambers across the continent.
Your report also looks at the impact of the pandemic on people's political and social attitudes. How did people in different countries respond to rules about social distancing, wearing masks, lockdowns, school closings? And what is the connection to far-right extremism in those places, do you think?
Most of the far-right has kind of failed to capitalize on it. And it's really been a year in which there was many challenges faced by the far-right, especially those far-right parties that were in some form of government, were struggling to look good. But it also offered opportunities. And one of the really worrying things we talk about in the report that's linked to COVID-19 and the pandemic is this real explosion of the numbers of people across Europe engaging with conspiracy theory content. Mm. And part of this is coming through the anti-lockdown movements, through the anti-5G, the internet stuff, the anti-vaccine movements. And then, of course, on top of this, we've had the real explosion of the QAnon conspiracy theory.
Well, I want to ask you about that because your report actually looks at two phenomena that got their start in the U.S. Let's talk about QAnon and their debunked notion that Donald Trump was going to save the world. How has that taken hold in Europe, considering it started in North America?
Really, at the beginning of last year, I mean, Hope Not Hate, where I work in the UK, we monitored a tiny handful of QAnon-related people or groups in the UK and Europe. And by the middle of last year, in the summer and by the autumn, there was thousands and thousands and hundreds of thousands of people in groups. It exploded. It came across the Atlantic, often on things like Facebook, Twitter, the major social media platforms. And what we saw is, on many of these big anti-lockdown demonstrations in the last year, there was a QAnon presence.
So the other U.S.-based dynamic that you looked at was Black Lives Matter, especially after the killing of George Floyd. How did that play out in Europe?
Well, as within America, there was both positive and negative responses to Black Lives Matter. I mean, in some ways, we had these really wonderful, huge demonstrations in large parts of Europe. You know, there was very few major cities in Europe and in the UK that didn't see pro-Black Lives Matter demonstrations. But of course, we did also see, similarly, a backlash from the far right, and it's not as widespread a support as one might hope.
So let me ask you this. In Italy, Mario Draghi, a technocrat, has been sworn in as prime minister after several years of far right rumbling from the Lega and Prime Minister Matteo Salvini. Now Italy seems to be getting its house in order in the midst of the pandemic. So can a crisis like a pandemic across Europe get countries to focus on social programs for everybody and dial back the hate? Is this a moment?
I think there's absolutely a moment happening here, and it's still up in the air, of course, which way this coin is going to land. One of the amazing things we've seen in Europe during this pandemic, or all over the world, in fact, is social solidarity, people getting to know their neighbours, people like working together through a crisis. But as I said, the far right is also poised. You know, we're going to have some very, very troubling times ahead, especially with economic downturns expected. Many of the economic crises that are going to follow from some of these very long and strict lockdowns, the far right will be ready to exploit this issue around closing borders, attacking migrants, blaming non-white people, and they're going to only continue to do that. So yes, there's a chance here, and we have to be hopeful that we can grab it with both hands and move forward to it and use the kind of social solidarity in a positive way, but we need to be really, really wary that the far right's going to be ready to try and do the opposite.
Joe Mulhall is senior researcher at Hope Not Hate, a UK-based anti-fascism and anti-racism organization. He was telling us about A State of Hate, Far-Right Extremism in Europe, a report that he edited, which came out today. Joe, thank you very much.
Thanks very much for having me.
It is chilly out there. Record low temperatures across the Midwest and South today have brought rolling blackouts affecting millions of Americans. In negative 9-degree weather in Kansas City, generators switched on. On the other side of the Atlantic, they're out skating on Amsterdam's frozen canals. And a once-in-a-decade snowfall saw a snowman on the Acropolis and kids in snowball fights in the streets of Athens. Our environment editor, Carolyn Beeler, joins me now to talk about what's up with this wacky and frankly dangerous winter weather for people not prepared for it. Hey, Carolyn.
Hey, Marco.
So it seems the polar vortex is once again the culprit here, yeah?
That's right. And that's an actual scientific term. It's not just social media speak for when it gets super cold. The polar vortex is this swirling mass of cold air that usually spins around up in the Arctic. And it usually stays pretty well penned in up there, kept there in part by the jet stream. And what's happening right now is that the polar vortex, it is all messed up. It's actually slipped out of the Arctic. It's way down south in the U.S. right now. And this disruption is also what's causing the snowfall and record cold in parts of Europe right now.
You mentioned the jet stream. Refresh my memory on what role that plays.
So the jet stream are these winds that blow west to east around the globe, farther south than the polar vortex. And it helps keep weather systems moving, and it also helps keep that cold air penned up in the north. But when the jet stream is sort of less strong, when these winds become wavy, it can allow the cold air to slide down the globe from the Arctic down farther south into the US, Europe, and Asia, across the globe. And they can actually basically start poking at the polar vortex too and toppling that spinning top on top of the globe over, helping to send it down to places like Texas.
Right, really far south. And Carolyn, this is a question that always comes up with weird weather these days. Is there a climate change link?
There are lots of factors that drive winter weather, but it does look like the warming of our planet is one of them. These weird jaunts that the polar vortex takes down south are not new. They happen every couple of years on average, but there are studies that document an increase in these little trips down south for that icy weather. The science of why exactly is not settled, and you know, it's always hard to prove cause and effect. There is evidence to suggest that warming is making the jet stream more wavy, like we talked about, more likely to let that cold air escape down south. And that's especially true when there are other forces that are also poking at the polar vortex, trying to knock that spinning top over.
Other forces like what?
Well, an especially warm Arctic. High temperatures and low sea ice cover, which we've had this year in key areas. The warm air can basically help deform the polar vortex and get it to be all wonky. And we know that the Arctic is warming twice as fast as the rest of the planet. And climate scientists will tell you that what happens in the Arctic does not stay in the Arctic.
Yeah, I've heard the phrase global weirding. Is that what's going on here?
Yeah, we know that overall, on average, climate change is causing warmer winters. That's for sure. But scientists are starting to link more and more wacky winter weather in some cases, caused often by the polar vortex, with climate change.
The World's Environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler, thanks so much for checking in on this very cold and somewhat weird day.
You're welcome, Marco.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Imagine an observatory like a global weather forecasting center, except it wouldn't monitor for things like hurricanes. Instead, it would be on the lookout for viruses circulating in humans and the next pandemic threat. Jessica Metcalf is a disease ecologist at Princeton who's been thinking a lot about how to create a pilot program for such an observatory. Professor Metcalf, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So a world observatory for the next pandemic, how would this work actually?
The point is that each of us is this incredibly delicate sensor to all the pathogens that are flying around. And yet, although we take samples from ourselves every day, everywhere across the United States and across the world, there are blood samples taken, there are blood banks, and then we throw them away instead of leveraging the information that is contained in these samples.
Mm. Fundamentally, you're mapping people's biodata. Are there privacy concerns around this?
Absolutely. I think it's an incredibly important point and an incredibly important question. We are getting better and better at grappling with how we handle these sorts of privacy concerns. But I do think no one should take their eye off that ball, and there's a lot to be figured out.
So how does this differ from what exists now, like global influenza tracking systems set up through the World Health Organization?
So there are many wonderful programs that focus specifically on the pathogens, and these really go looking for the viral presence itself, so viral DNA or RNA. One potential important shift here would be not to be looking for cases of people who are actually sick, but looking at everyone and looking for clues in everyone to figure out what the landscape of immunity is or isn't. So who is and who isn't susceptible to infection? Because I might have something like flu or measles for just a very short window of time. So by the time I walked into a surveillance center, it might be long gone. However, my blood will contain a signature that I was infected, potentially forever.
So can you give us an example of how blood samples, on a smaller scale perhaps, have already helped monitor and predict outbreaks?
The example I keep coming back to is some lovely work that my graduate student led in Madagascar. This is on a very well-known virus. So the virus is measles. And there is this phenomenon where if you've had a decade without measles cases, that could be for a good reason, which is that a lot of people have been vaccinated, or it could be for a bad reason, which is that there's not a lot of virus circulating. But say, for example, you've missed 10% of kids in your vaccination program every year. So every year, about 10% of the children who are born won't get into the program. But then when a kind of spark hits this fuel of potentially infectable children, you can end up with a very large outbreak. So in Madagascar, there'd been a decade without measles, and it wasn't clear whether it was for a good reason or if it was for a bad reason. And the way you can see this is by looking at serology, so looking for antibodies in the blood. And we worked with colleagues in Madagascar to leverage samples that they had sitting in their freezers, which were from the fever rash surveillance. So when a child is suspected of measles, a blood sample gets sent in. Mm. All that they do at that stage is look to see whether the child has antibody markers for currently circulating infection, so short-term markers of infection. And all we did was say, well, let's look for the longer-term markers of infections, the ones that tell you whether the child ever has been either vaccinated or exposed to measles. And when we did that, we found that there was this big pool of children who were still susceptible to measles, which suggested that a large outbreak was coming. And tragically, the outbreak then happened, and more than 10,000 children died in Madagascar. But the signatures were there in this landscape of immunity that we could pull out from this, you know, very erratic sample, but it still provided that important clue.
Professor, with the Madagascar example that you gave, you saw what was absent. On the flip side, though, are you saying with this approach, this monitoring system, we could have identified and reacted to an unknown virus or something like COVID sooner, even though it doesn't identify a specific virus?
That's a great question. So I think what we would see would be a signature that something wasn't right, right? We would have to know, again, what was normal, because there are ebbs and flows in what our signatures of immunity contain. There is flu season, so suddenly you'll see an uptick in antibodies to influenza. There's enteroviruses that tend to perk up during the summer. Mm. So you'd need to know what was normal for that particular time of year before you could say, oh, there's something weird going on. We're seeing, you know, 10 times the amount of coronaviruses at this time of year relative to what we'd expect. One of the signatures of these emergent pathogens is often that they are not constrained to such a great degree by the climate drivers or the behavioral drivers that drive endemic infections, so infections that circulate regularly, simply because everybody in the world is susceptible to them.
So you've been working on the concept of a global virus observatory with researchers from Harvard, the National Institutes of Health, and the Wellcome Trust in the UK. Would you say you're at a point where this is a project, or is it more a proposal that you kind of hope gets done?
I think it's certainly more of a proposal that we hope gets done. But I think there's many strong steps forwards in these directions. So there's the exemplar of the lovely work that Michael Minner at Harvard is doing to start trying to coordinate the use of discarded samples. We have colleagues at the National Institutes for Allergy and Infectious Diseases who are beginning to think in the domain of serosurveillance and how it could be used. And then there are efforts in the UK that could fall under this larger profile. It's a dream and a vision at the moment. It's not a specific project, but it is one to which many different flowers are blooming.
Jessica Metcalf is a disease ecologist at Princeton University. Thank you so much for your time, Jessica.
Thank you for having me.
Kids all over the world have been cooped up for a long time during the pandemic. That includes Jeremiah Carter in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. He's 10 years old and has a golden doodle named Nala. And like other kids deprived of sports and after-school activities right now, his days needed some structure, so he and his parents worked out a schedule.
Monday, we do like a connect night, and then we do like a music night on Tuesday, and Thursday is usually the day that we start on our stick library.
Yeah, you heard that right. Stick library. Jeremiah builds stick libraries. They're like those little free libraries along neighborhood sidewalks for books, but for sticks. For dogs to chase. The idea started in New Zealand and has spread around the world since. His dad, David Carter, explains.
Some of the dog parks have a limited amount of trees, and those trees get well used. And so the idea is to have a wooden container for sticks that's at the gate of the dog park. Dogs can take a stick and play with it and hopefully drop it off on their way out.
David Carter thought about building these stick libraries as a learning opportunity for his son. It involved new skills, like measuring.
We found out that our dog's favorite stick length was, like, about 2 feet.
And Jeremiah learned how to use tools to build the little wooden library.
I got to learn how to use the nail gun. I got to shoot some nails in. And then also we had this burning tool that I burned the letters on.
We did have a small incident with the nail gun, but my finger is feeling a lot better now.
And the son has to watch over the dad, it seems. The Carters installed their first stick library at their neighborhood dog park earlier this school year. Then they built what they called a branch library at another park across town. Yeah, good one, guys. Jeremiah says maintaining the libraries is a daily task.
I've noticed just about every time we go there, we have to go through the trees and collect some, but
we're just happy to see it being used. And if it means when we go to take our dog for a walk, we collect an armful of sticks and put them back in there, we're happy to do that.
Take a stick, leave a stick. David Carter and his son Jeremiah, recorded by the CBC show Saskatoon Morning. Thanks for thinking of the dogs, you two. We'll be right back. You're with the world. Hi there, Marco here. During these unprecedented times, human connection is more important than ever. At The World, our community connects people from all over the globe. The evidence? 1,098 people from across the globe donated during the World's fundraising campaign. Here are just a few of those supporters. Connie Hamm, Paul Spagnoli, Tara Campbell, Anne Canther, Patricia Jerwitz, Joel Flores, Matt Schley, Edie Ekasiotu, Benjamin Wong, and Jasmina Nielsen. These names, just a fraction of the vast and diverse community that helps keep the world free and accessible to all. From everybody here at The World, thank you for your support. The military is still in charge in Myanmar. Different ethnic groups are joining together to resist it.
We need to work together for this country to work and not become a failed nation, which is already on the way.
Plus, eating less venison in the UK doesn't necessarily translate into a good thing for the deer. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We come to you from GBH Boston and PRX. 2 weeks after seizing total power in a coup, the military in Myanmar says it will not be in power for long. They're promising another election and saying they'll hand over authority to whomever wins. What they're not saying, though, is when that election will happen. Huge protests are still happening across Myanmar by day, and by night, when police come to neighborhoods searching for protesters to arrest, the residents turn out banging pots and pans. Many people just want their democracy back, but Myanmar's ethnic minorities say this uprising needs to go much further, as the World's Patrick Nguyen reports.
When Stella Na was a little girl, going to school in the hilly northern part of Myanmar, she learned all about the greatness of the Burmese, the country's dominant ethnic group. She learned about their ancient kings, how they built golden temples and had mighty armies. That was fine, but what about her ethnic group, the Kachin, with more than a million people, mostly living in the mountains? Well, the textbooks didn't say much about them at all.
About the Kachin people was about two lines. We were just learning as if we were learning about some people who were extinct already.
Not totally extinct. The school said the Kachin were farmers who liked to do this neat dance. Stella says that was about it.
We were nothing more than some cute people with not much history.
This is how the country's military rulers, who are all ethnically Burmese, tend to see minorities, as people who should just assimilate, get out of the way. But in Myanmar, more than a third of all people are minorities. Groups such as the Shan, Kachin, Karen, Kayin, Mon, Wa, Rakhine, Chin, Rohingya, it is a very diverse place. Yet the army has been trying to colonize their indigenous lands for decades. Often brutally, even blasting villages with fighter jets. I asked Stella Na, who is now a political writer and activist, how her people, the Kachin, tend to feel about the army.
Disgust, fear. They feel disgusted of the military for all the human rights abuses that they have committed against the community members.
2 weeks ago, when the generals seized total power in a coup, rolling tanks through major cities, including the heartland, where most Burmese people live, Stella Na and other minorities were like, yeah, looks familiar.
I even have someone asking me, how do you feel to lose the freedom all of a sudden? I'm like, I never felt like we had the freedom to begin with, right?
Myanmar is now in the throes of a huge uprising, a people's uprising, with doctors and students and factory workers on strike, everyday people standing up to tanks and riot cops. And rarely has the whole country, all the racial groups, been united, united in anger at the military. For Stella Na, it feels pivotal. Like, okay, now maybe we're all on the same page.
This is an opportunity maybe to help them understand a bit, but also we can't really hope and expect too much because they are so focused on releasing, freeing Aung San Suu Kyi.
Aung San Suu Kyi, the most popular political leader in the country ever, especially among the Burmese majority. She is backed by the U.S., and for the past 5 years, Aung San Suu Kyi has shared power with the army. Until the coup, that was the status quo. And what many minorities are now telling their Burmese brothers and sisters is, let's fight for a real democracy. Because that status quo, for many, it was miserable. That's a village on fire. A village once home to Rohingya Muslims, following an army purge about 3 years ago. The army has violently driven more than 1 million Rohingya out of the country. Here's Ne San Luen, a Rohingya activist.
You know, military is the one who committed the genocide against the Rohingya. So we have no reason to support this military coup.
But he does say that for his people, the coup doesn't change much. Many already live under an apartheid-like system. For example, most Rohingya can't vote. And yes, he says, some Rohingya refugees did enjoy seeing Aung San Suu Kyi get ousted. After all, Aung San Suu Kyi did go to The Hague in 2019 to defend the army against charges of genocide. But Ne San Luen says that celebrating was just a knee-jerk reaction.
We informed them this is not the right way to enjoy detention of Aung San Suu Kyi. We have to support the public movement, even if we don't want to support her or the her party.
They take the long view, he says, that the army will never change its ways, but maybe in the future, elected officials might begin to stick up for the Rohingya. So now in refugee camps, you can hear this. Rohingya, survivors of genocide, beating pots and pans in solidarity with Burmese protesters. Ne San Luen is even seeing Burmese people who never stood up for the Rohingya saying, sorry, we should have done something.
They realize the cruelty of this military and they have the sympathy for us.
But like Stella Na, he knows racism won't just go away overnight.
This racism is deeply rooted in the country, you know, so it will take a lot of time to change.
Only they don't have time. This mass resistance is happening now, And Stella Na says it needs to become a more inclusive fight, not just for democracy, but to get the army off minorities' backs once and for all. That's what brings Kachin people out on the streets in her hometown, Michina. You see fewer protest signs about Aung San Suu Kyi and more that say abolish the constitution, basically overhaul the entire system. But this is how security forces responded to that over the weekend. A barrage of rubber bullets, maybe some real bullets, seemingly fired in the air, no confirmed casualty. That's from a Facebook live stream. But the army keeps blocking the internet nationwide, in part to keep the world from seeing these crackdowns. What's clear is that resistance is becoming very dangerous for everyone. That's why Stella Na says the only solution is to stick together.
So we need to work together for this country to work and not become a failed nation, which is already on the way.
Myanmar's minority groups know quite well, she says, that this army will not back down easily. For the world, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
France's cybersecurity agency says several French entities have been breached in a hacking campaign. They say the GRU, Russia's military intelligence agency, is behind the intrusions, and they date back to late 2017. Today, Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov denied the French charges, calling them absurd. For more on this, we're joined by Jérôme Billois. He's a cybersecurity expert with the IT consulting firm Wavestone. First of all, Jérôme, what do we know so far about this hack? How big is it?
The exact size of the hack is not very clear. The agency has still yet to communicate on the list of the victims. We're talking about approximately 15 companies that were concerned by this cyber attack.
I see some names like Airbus, Air France, Thales, the French electric company, and the telecom firm Orange. I mean, that seems to be some fairly high-level places that got hacked. How deep did those hacks go?
So far, what we know is that the name of the companies you mentioned are users of the software that was apparently hacked. But this software has hundreds of customers, and so far, none of these names have confirmed being the target of the attack. So that's why I said it's quite blurry, and the situation is difficult here now in France, because we have this attack, we know it could be serious, but we're still missing a lot of data points to really assess the depths of the attack.
So authorities in France have attributed the attack to the Russian GRU. How certain are they that Russia is really behind this, and what data points do you need to have that confirmed?
They collected many, many data points about the attack itself, the way it has been done, the attack software that are used. So regarding the report, they know for sure that the way the attack has been conducted is very, very similar to the way the Sandworm group do the attack usually. And we know that the Sandworm group is linked with the Russian state. It's not 100% attribution, but it's a high confidence anyway.
And remind us briefly, what is Sandworm?
Sandworm is the code name for a group of cyber attackers that is mostly confirmed to be linked to the Russian government. This Sandworm group has been indicted by the US government, and they linked the group to six specific individuals working for the Russian government.
So if the Russian government is in fact behind this, what information would they be looking to get a hold of? What is the goal, do you think?
If they are behind this hack, there are many different solutions. We all know that intelligence services, they look for two things. First, it could be a way to steal information about the targets that they have hacked, on how the company is working, confidential data, personal data, and so on. Or it could be also a way to pre-position themselves into the networks of these companies to hack them or to stop them when they decide, in a way to destabilize some critical processes in our country.
So last year, as you alluded to, the U.S. also experienced a major cyber attack, the SolarWinds hack. Now there's a major investigation in the U.S. How do you think France is going to respond to this breach?
I think it's going to be a similar response. As far as I know today, lots of companies that are using this SentryOn software are investigating right now to know if they have been breached or not. What has been revealed by our National Cybersecurity Agency is the list of public-facing companies that have been attacked. But so far, we don't know exactly how many companies that have this software internally may have been attacked as well. So the investigations are ongoing.
So finally, when it comes to stopping other hacks, Jérôme, do you believe that France has the infrastructure to stop future, perhaps more sophisticated cyber attacks like this? And if not, what systems need to be put in place?
France has been investing a lot on cybersecurity, and if you follow the news, you will see that on Thursday there is going to be a strong budget announcement from the government to enhance this cybersecurity. So I would say we're not in the perfect situation, because like every other countries, we have years and years of insufficient investments to cope with, but the situation is getting better by the day.
Jérôme Billois, a cybersecurity expert with the IT consulting firm Wavestone. Thank you for breaking this down for us. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
Britain is now entering the seventh week of its strictest lockdown yet, with all restaurants, pubs, and non-essential shops closed to the public by law. The good news is that rates of infection are beginning to fall, but far away from towns and cities, lockdown is having some strange side effects. Reporter Leo Hornack has been looking into an unexpected consequence of the pandemic in the English countryside.
Francesca Schoons and her husband have been visiting rural Suffolk in eastern England for more than 25 years. But in all her time there, this kind of thing has only happened once.
I was driving along a road. It was 8:30 in the morning. It was clear light. And suddenly, directly in front of me, a deer leapt out from the hedge.
She couldn't swerve to avoid the animal. There was oncoming traffic.
There was nowhere I could go. I hit the deer with my front bumper and I saw it somersault across the road.
She managed to keep control of the car just, then pulled over. She felt terrible.
And I was thinking, how on earth am I going to deal with this poor animal, which is almost certainly not dead? Have I got anything in the car I can dispatch it with? And when I looked back, having stopped the car, it had disappeared.
The deer had probably kept moving from sheer adrenaline. A local farmer later told her he found it injured and had to put it out of its misery. And the car, it was basically a write-off. This all happened 4 years ago, but it might be a taste of the future. Gradually, over recent decades, the deer population in places like Suffolk has been building and building.
Oh, absolutely, yes. 25 years ago, seeing deer here. It was a really rare occurrence. Now there are huge numbers.
Deer kind of like the Anthropocene. They're thriving. It's hard to be sure of exact numbers. Deer aren't great at filling out census forms. But according to Britain's Deer Initiative Group, numbers have more than doubled in the last two decades. Some believe there are more wild deer in Britain now than at any time in the last 1,000 years.
There are no wolves, bears, coyotes, anything in Britain.
Mike Robinson is a chef and award-winning restaurateur specialising in wild food. He's also a hunter. You might have seen his TV show, Eating the Wild.
Man and road traffic accidents is pretty much the sole cause of death of all deer in the UK. So we have no predators, so it's down to us to control them.
The problem is, the last year wasn't really a normal one for humans. Since COVID, our behaviour as the sole apex predator has changed drastically.
Lockdown started in March last year. So I've found myself with a large responsibility to have to manage these deer, but no market in the restaurants because they're all closed. Obviously, you close all the restaurants and what happens? Everything stops.
In Britain, people don't tend to eat deer venison at home. It's seen as fancy food for dining out on a special occasion. And without restaurants open to serve it, demand cratered. Hunters stopped hunting. But the deer kept breeding.
And that is all over the country. Basic math says that if you have a year where you harvest only 20% of the normal deer harvest, then you will have a massive growth in population the following year. That's just basic math.
I actually went down and did a cull last weekend.
Jamie Corrie is one of those affected by the basic maths. He runs a hunting and outdoor skills school called Wild Bushcraft.
And, you know, in a field where you're supposed to be seeing maybe two or three roe deer in a field, in a group, when I went down last weekend in two fields, I counted 21 deer. 21.
And why does this matter? Why does it matter if you're seeing more deer? So what?
Yeah, so it matters on a number of levels. So one is on the deer themselves. there's not enough food. The second thing is the impact on the habitats that the deer live in. Especially in woodland, they will eat all the ground flora and they'll browse on the trees above them. Basically, you get this desert running through the woodland.
Another gamekeeper told me that in the long run, deer without predators will literally eat a forest to death, tearing up the young tree saplings before they can grow strong, leaving nothing to replace the older trees as they die. Locusts with antlers, essentially. And then there are more direct risks.
If there's more deer around, then there's going to be more deer crossing roads. You know, there are numerous deaths every year caused by deer hitting cars. The other part of the human impact is disease, because deer are carriers of numerous diseases, blue tongue, foot and mouth, and then Lyme's disease. And I know where we are, we've seen Lyme's disease creep in, and it can be fatal if it's not treated properly.
We're going to see more and more of these kind of butterfly wing effects as the aftershocks of the pandemic emerge. How closing posh restaurants in one year could result in more car accidents the next. Or how social distancing rules against COVID could ultimately increase the spread of Lyme's disease in humans. Of course, one solution for those of us Brits who do eat meat could be to start eating venison at home.
It's the most sustainable, it's the most ethical, and it's the most healthy red meat that you can buy.
Especially when we can entertain again.
I love it because it just blows their mind. And they're just like, how is this stuff not more readily available?
For The World in London, Leo Hornack.
Like many of you, our team here at The World is mostly working from home, but our virtual newsroom, that's still a constant buzz. Join the conversation with us on Twitter. Our handle is easy to remember. We're at The World. Or hit me up. I'm at Marco Werman, MarcoWerman. The Kurdish-controlled territory of northern Iraq doesn't look much like a region at war. In its largest city, Erbil, restaurants are crowded, schools are open, and life usually goes on peacefully. Not so much last night.
When I was outside, there was a sound of three explosions, and people freaked out a little bit.
That's Erbil resident, author, and analyst Vladimir Van Vilgenberg. He heard incoming missiles slam into the city's airport last night and others that landed in residential areas. The attack killed a civilian contractor with the American-led military coalition and wounded six others, including a U.S. service member. Van Vilgenberg says people in Erbil were not surprised when a militia backed by Iran claimed responsibility for the attack.
This is not the first time that this happens, that Iranian-backed groups or Iran, they fired missiles or rockets at Erbil. Now, I've been living here for quite a long time, and it started with a ballistic missile attack by Iran in 2018. And then later, there were also other incidents. But this was the first time that actually rockets fell in a civilian area. So people are wondering, where is this going to end?
Yeah, the missiles killed a civilian contractor with the American-led military coalition, wounded six others. What are those contractors actually doing in Erbil?
Because the U.S. is trying to limit the number of troops overseas, they are dependent on contractors to do logistical support and other additional work. So, for instance, contractors could help with, refueling, with keeping military vehicles on the road. It could also be people running restaurants. There are people from different countries that are helping on those military bases to basically keep the show going on.
A little-known Iranian-backed militia group has claimed responsibility for the attack. Who are they and what do you know about them?
Iran officially denied any involvement in the attack, but after the death of the Iranian general Qasem Soleimani in January last year, there has been the creation of some of those smaller groups which act on their own, but they are probably proxy groups for bigger groups that are backed by Iran. Those groups have been carrying out attacks on, for instance, logistical supplies, convoys to military bases. So they're basically used as a sort of deniability by Iranian-backed forces to say like, oh, we have nothing to do with this. And they have these small groups that then claim attacks in revenge for the death of the Iranian top general.
Right. So this is the first missile attack on U.S. forces since President Biden took office, and it was aimed at a place where such attacks don't happen that frequently. Is what we're seeing here Iran testing the incoming Biden administration? Is this the continuing narrative of Iranian militias targeting like the U.S. embassy in Baghdad and then the retaliation for the U.S. killing of that top Iranian general?
Yeah, obviously it's a test. The last few weeks of the Trump administration, Iran actually instructed groups that they are supporting not to do anything against the U.S. because they were fearing that Trump could use military force, because there were also B-52s in the air. There was also the Nimitz air carrier close by in the region and a submarine. Mm-hmm. And they basically said, we're still going to do revenge for the death of Qasem Soleimani, because the anniversary was in January. But Iran was saying the revenge will come when it's time for them to do it. So I think it's like a way to test the current U.S. administration and see what their red lines are. Under the Trump administration, basically the red line was, if an American gets killed, then there will be a military response. But this didn't happen. So most likely it will stay with condemnations, and they're probably going to try to work with the Iraqis and the Kurds to investigate the incident.
I mean, the U.S. military still has about 2,500 troops in Iraq. It's pulled out of some bases but remains at others. What's been the reaction of people in Erbil to being in the middle of this seeming proxy battle between Iran and the U.S.?
The people in Erbil, they're a little bit unhappy that the U.S. didn't do more to stop Iranian-backed groups and Iraqi army from taking territories of the Kurdish Peshmerga forces. But in general, life continues in the Kurdistan region. I mean, the restaurants are open, the hotels are open. Of course, there's also the COVID pandemic, so it's not like in the past. But I mean, in general, life is quite stable. But from time to time, there is this kind of incidents.
Vladimir von Vilgenberg lives in Erbil. He's an analyst and author of The Kurds of Northern Syria, Governance, Diversity, and Conflicts. Vladimir, thank you for being with us.
You're welcome. No problem.
Today is Mardi Gras, Fat Tuesday. That means king cake for folks in Louisiana. But for Polish Americans, there's a different sweet to look forward to. Punchki, super rich donuts eaten before the start of Lent. And Erika Piasek is an expert. She's the owner of Piasek Pierogi in Detroit and took some time out of making and delivering punchki today to speak with us. Thanks for a few minutes of your time, Erika. Punchki, the plural, and punchek, the singular. What makes a punchek, and not just a regular donut?
The dough is a lot less cakey. It's a much heavier dough base, as you are trying to use up all of your sugars and anything you have laying around in preparation for Lent. Traditionally, punchki will have fillings that are very rich custards or preserves of different fruit fillings. And mostly they're covered with plain sugar or a sugared glaze.
And are they baked or fried like a donut?
They are fried in lard traditionally.
Wow, fried in lard, not holding back.
Oh, yeah. No holding back. Well, you're giving everything up for 40 days, so you might as well go big or go home.
Exactly. Detroit is home to your shop, of course, and also some of the biggest Punchki Day celebrations in the U.S. How would people normally be celebrating today, that is, in the before times?
Typically on Fat Tuesday, our storefront open in Detroit, and then we also travel back to Hamtramck. If you don't know where Hamtramck is, it's a very densely populated Polish community in one of the suburbs of Detroit. On almost every corner in Hamtramck, there's a bar. Wow. And on Fat Tuesday, every single one of those bars opens at 7 a.m. with punchki and Polish beers and yeji.
What's yeji?
In Hamtramck, we call it the welcome handshake, but it is a blackberry brandy.
How is COVID changing how things are done this year and how much is done?
The only event we really had was our pre-order and storefront purchasing. We typically do a Fat Thursday event. Saturday morning, our friends make a punchki vodka that own Detroit City Distillery, and we do an event with them. And we don't have any of those events this year.
Erika, are you going to do Lent, and are you going to have one final punchek before the 40 days?
Oh, yes. I always participate in Lent. I feel like it's a really good time to just let your mental, spiritual, physical health have some type of cleanse. And I've had about six already today, but I'm pretty sure I'll probably have about six more. And then I don't really eat them for 6 months.
And what will be the last one you eat? Like the last perfect taste of punchek on your lips before you go into Lent?
Oh, my absolute favorite is raspberry preserves. So I always choose raspberry as my last one.
Erika Piasek is the chef and owner of Piasek Pierogi in Detroit, putting the gras back in Mardi Gras with their incredible punchki. Great to speak with you, Erika. Thank you.
Thank you.
The World comes to you from the Nana Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe. Stay strong. We'll see you again right here tomorrow.